BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, I'm Lauren Laverne, and this is the Desert Island Discs podcast. Every week, I ask my guests to choose the 8 tracks, book, and luxury they'd want to take with them if they were cast away to a desert island. This is an extended version of the original Radio 4 broadcast, and for rights reasons, the music is shorter than the original broadcast. I hope you enjoy listening. My castaway this week is the writer Marlon James. Widely hailed as one of the most important literary voices to emerge in the 21st century, he won the Booker Prize in 2015 for his epic novel, A Brief History of Seven Killings, that centres on the 1976 assassination attempt against Bob Marley. Born in Kingston, Jamaica, Marlon was 6 when the events in the novel took place. He may have been destined to turn his talents to a story about crime eventually. As the son of a police officer mother and a lawyer father, he grew up in a family who joked that his mother locked criminals up and his father got them out. The road to success has been a long one. He published his first novel, John Crow's Devil, at 34, after it had been rejected 78 times and after he believed he had destroyed every existing copy of his manuscript. More on that later. He also teaches creative writing and gives students this advice. If you're a writer, you have to believe in yourself. Because if you're a writer, you're going to come across that moment where you're the only one who does. Marlon James, welcome to Desert Island Discs.
Thanks for having me.
Pleasure. So tell me a little bit more about this idea of self-belief. Have you always had it? Is it something you've had to develop?
I didn't always have it, and I'm still working on it. I didn't believe in myself, which is why I destroyed that manuscript when I couldn't get anybody to read it, much less buy it. You know, I threw away that manuscript. I went back into advertising and design, which is what I was doing, and I pretty much forgot about being a writer. And if it wasn't for a bunch of forces, including Kaylee Jones, that great novelist and daughter of James Jones, coming to Jamaica and me going to her workshop and she insisting on not leaving the country until I found the manuscript and gave to her, which I did under duress.
It was your friends, I think, who said, he's got a manuscript, he's got a novel.
It wasn't even a friend. It was somebody else in the workshop who I hadn't seen in a year. They just remembered I wrote a book. She would not take no for an answer. And I had to find it in an email outbox and send it to her. And I remember because I didn't have enough paper, so I had to cut the first 20 pages and the last 20 pages. Clearly, I didn't need them because nobody ever said, this novel feels like it's missing something. And sent it to her, and she loved it, and she showed it to her publisher, and that was that. But it was not because of belief in myself. And my advice to my students is just don't do what I did. 78 people can be wrong, and sometimes majority just means all the wrong people are on the same side.
So tell me a little bit more about teaching. You teach creative writing and have done for some years in Minnesota. What do you enjoy about it?
I enjoy teaching undergrads. So I like teaching kids who are just discovering their voice and just discovering that they can actually write or want to, or discovering that they're terrible and shouldn't do it. It's something about being so creative just for creativity's sake that I find really, really almost kind of intoxicating because I'm so not that.
Oh, really?
I mean, I write with purpose. I write to pick up a paycheck, you know. Writing for me is work, and I love that it's work, but it's work. For them, writing is almost play. Writing is figuring themselves out and just sort of tapping into this vast possibility of what they can be.
And tell me about the music that you're going to be sharing with us today. 8 special pieces of music. Do you listen to it when you're writing?
I listen to music when I'm writing. I listen to music with everything. I mean, I'm Jamaican. We do everything to a soundtrack. I just don't trust silence. Silence to me feels like deafness. It feels like absence of sound. It doesn't feel like an alternative to noise. It feels like the absence of sound. And I don't trust it. It makes me very uneasy.
So with that in mind, tell me about your first piece of music today. What are we going to hear?
We're going to hear Tenor Saws, Ring the Alarm. Reggae started out in a lot of ways just as how hip-hop started out, where it's not just that it was street music or ghetto music. It was the music of people who couldn't afford instruments. It was also young enough that the older kids wouldn't like it. It still felt kind of rebellious listening to a song like Ring the Alarm. It turns out, of course, it was one of the paradigm shifts for reggae music and a stunning, brilliant song. But back then, it was just, it was a sound of being 11, 12, 13.
Hey, ring the alarm. Hey, whoa. Ring the alarm. Another sound is dying. Whoa. Hey, ring the alarm. Another sound is dying. Whoa. Hey, some sound sound like a big jump on. Listen to sound, it's a champion. Run the dance in any session. Rock up the woman and rock up the man.
Tenasaur and Ring the Alarm. Marlon James, you've published four novels so far, and it was your third, A Brief History of Seven Killings, that won the Man Booker Prize in 2015. And looking at footage of the evening, your reaction to the announcement seems to be one of genuine surprise. What do you remember of that moment?
It was genuine surprise. I was absolutely shocked. I really didn't think I was going to win. And I'm pretty sure I may still have the most rambling, incoherent Booker Prize speech ever. Certainly the shortest. In hindsight, I guess, yeah, I should have known. But I was absolutely stunned. I remember when they were about to announce the verdict, I got up to go to the bathroom, and I was like, whatever. He's like, I'm going to go. And I should have known when three people followed me.
To make sure you got back on time.
Yeah, they even stayed near the stall. I'm like, you people have got to be kidding. And it was a woman, too, in the men's stall. well, I don't know if she knew. I think it was just need everybody in the room.
And with a longer view on it, what difference has winning the prize made to life for you?
It made a lot of difference. For one, there's all that book sales. Selling a book sure beats not selling a book. And it's galvanized a lot of things. Brief History has been translated in nearly 30 languages. I also think there's a type of reader who'd come across this book, some liking it, some thoroughly hating it, but both coming to it because of the exposure of something at the Booker Prize. Because I think writers like me, I mean, our books, you know, we sell decent numbers, we earn out our advance, we bring some acclaim to the publisher, but we don't storm the bestseller list. Not part of the whole popular literary imagination. It does take something like a prize, I think, to make some people curious. And that prize did that.
And you were the first Jamaican author to win the prize. What was the reaction to the news there?
It was, for the most part, celebratory. But it was also slightly complicated because that was the same year I came out in the New York Times, and Jamaica is still going through some issues with homophobia. When I went back, funny enough, to do the Bob Marley lecture, the excitement of people wanting to see and hear what I had to say was fantastic. At the same time, somebody created a Facebook group solely saying, should a homosexual give the Bob Marley speech? That's the sole purpose of the Facebook group. There's steps forward and there's steps back. Mm. I think we're making more steps forward than back, but make no mistake, the backward steps are there.
Well, we're going to talk about that a little bit more later, but for now, it's time for your second piece of music, Marlon James. Tell me what it is and why you've chosen it.
I remember the first time I heard Nick Drake and I didn't like him. I think because I was listening to him at maybe 10:30 in the morning, I was at work. And I took it home. I didn't get home till 9:30 in the night. I took it home. I put it in my CD player, maybe around 11. I put it in, it was 1993. I did not take that out of my CD player till 1998. It never left. And I played it nearly every night. And there's so much Nick Drake to pick. But Things Behind the Sun was the one I kept pressing repeat, 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 repeat. Every time it plays, there's this ghost in the room.
Please be wider than that star, the lonely smile to see while you're dying away. And once you've seen what they've been to, when the earth just won't seem worth a night or a day. Oh yeah, what I say. Look around, you find the ground is not so far from where you are. Don't be too wise for
Nick Drake and Things Behind the Sun. So tell me a little bit more about growing up. You were born into a middle-class family in suburban Kingston, Jamaica.
I describe my childhood as kind of a typical suburban 70s, 80s childhood that nearly everybody else had. We're two working parents. We live in a three-bedroom house in the suburbs. I was raised by Sesame Street, watching soap operas or watching the A-Team. Or if it's Sunday, there'd be some lofty British series like The Far Pavilions or Jewel in the Crown or I, Claudius. And it was in a lot of ways very, very rich childhood, and in a lot of ways stultifyingly boring. It's suburbs everywhere.
Boredom is the correct crucible for a creative imagination, though, surely. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely, because you're trying to write your way out of it. Or sing your way out of it, or dance your way out of it. And I was writing weird stories and drawing comics and of course, listening to and buying tons and tons of music.
As I mentioned, your mother was a police officer mm-hmm. and your father was a lawyer. What did you know about their jobs when you were a kid?
I didn't know a lot, actually. They were very good at shielding work from us. Particularly my mom was so over it. The election 1980, there was actually a big shootout. Gunmen actually shot up her workplace, which was a major act of defense because she worked in Central Intelligence Headquarters. And they shot it up anyway just as to prove that they can.
So what was it like for you going back and researching? You know, when you were writing a brief history of mm-hmm. seven killings, it must have given you a different perspective on what they were doing while you were growing
well,
up.
Yeah, because my perspective back then, my perspective of, say, the 1976 was as a six-year-old. 1976, crisis for me is, who's my favorite Charlie's Angel? I still remember when Bob Marley got shot. But I remember it more as, one, a news report. But I also remember it as one of the few times any news unnerved my parents. And now I know why. Now it's because Marley was untouchable and was supposed to be untouchable. And if people could try to kill Bob Marley, then it means they could kill anybody. It never occurred to me until writing that book that that pulled the rug out from under them. This is one of the most certain things in their world, that Bob Marley is untouchable. And suddenly he got touched.
You've described your relationship with your dad as a peculiar kind of close, and I've read that you used to have Shakespeare duels with mm-hmm. him when you were growing up. Who won, usually?
Depends on the play. He would win with Julius Caesar. I'd win with Hamlet. Neither wins with Macbeth. I think that was our way of sort of bonding, because it's not like we ever talked about the issues. Mm-hmm. It was a complicated relationship in a sense that there were quite a few years I didn't even say a word to him. And, you know, we had a kind of reconciliation. I'm very glad, though, because he's no longer with us. Mm-hmm. And I'm glad we had that kind of sort of, it wasn't even an airing out. It was just a sort of declaring who we were. Of course, my mom was always there for me. And my mom was the type of person who would know things about me. And I would say things that I would never say to my dad.
It's time to go to the music, Marlon James. Tell me about your third disc today.
First heard Peter Gabriel when I was in high school, but he sort of sunk into my blood in college. And every time I think of Mercy Street, I think of rainy days in Jamaica, skipping college, and me and my friend Alicia and Robert and Damon and Alexis all in this car, rolling through Kingston. For some reason, no matter how fast you're going, you're gliding. And no matter what was going on out in the street, you never heard it. All you hear is rain on the windshield. And we're not saying anything to each other. We're just sort of letting Peter Gabriel fill the space. And it just is one of those joyous things. Which is funny because it's a sad song. But it's one of those memories I have of just utter joy.
Looking down on empty streets, all she can see are the dreams all made so. The dreams made real. All of the buildings, all of the cars were once just a dream in somebody's head. She pictures the broken glass, pictures the steam. She pictures the soul with no legal.
Mercy Street by Peter Gabriel, taking you back to some inexplicably joyful college days, Marlon James. So tell me more about you as a young boy. What kind of kid were you?
I mean, I was definitely a nerd, but I was definitely a geek. I was also probably the school sissy. I remember really, really loving comics and really, really wanting to live in any era but the one I was in. Loving comics and wishing I could fly. That fantasy left me way later than it should have. And just not feeling that I fit in at all.
How much understanding did you have of the ways in which you didn't fit? Was that something that you'd articulated to yourself at that point, or was it...
No, I think not necessarily articulated. I think I just found kindred spirits, really. That's one of the things we had, everybody else excluded us.
So who are you hanging out with?
I was hanging out with the other nerds. I was hanging out with the art kids. I was hanging out with the poor kids. I was hanging out with the kids who curse too much and smell bad. I was hanging out with the new kid who didn't yet realize he could do better than us. By summer, he did.
There's a story I read that I really don't want to be true because it's sad about your school days, that you pretended you weren't your brother's brother so that he wouldn't be teased.
It didn't feel sad back then. And I brought it up to me was not just my idol, but... I mean, he was like a second former with like fifth former cred. He was that cool. And being his brother, there are some expectations. I think I remember the incident where somebody screamed out some really nasty name and he heard it. And I was going like, I don't know who they're talking about. And he's like, it's you. They're talking about you. And I was like, oh, wow. And he was with all his cool friends. And just without even knowing it, I just decided that, you know what? I'm not going to ruin your cool or ruin your life. We're teenagers. We think that's coolness is life. The most we may have done is nodded at each other for the next 5 years. It's not like it's a big school. And then especially when he had to repeat a year, it ended up in my class. Nobody knew.
Wow.
We didn't sit near each other. We did not acknowledge each other. And it'd go, Andre James, Marlon James, present. We didn't take the same buses home. We didn't go the same routes. We didn't leave at the same time. And yeah, people were, to this day, people are stunned. They're like, you guys were related. I was like, he's my brother. I was like, how?
Let's go to some music then. This is your fourth disc today. Tell me about this one.
Well, this is a complete change up. So Nana Cherry, who remains the goddess of my existence, she was part of that sort of Buffalo aesthetic that was in Britain. And at the time, I wanted no more than to be living... I didn't even want to be in a British house. I just wanted to be on a British street. In the late 80s, it was like time of the Face magazine and Touch magazine and people dressing like, you know, dressing Buffalo style, and they're all wearing Boy London clothes, and I just wanted all of it. And she, to me, just seemed to just encapsulate all of that. And it was just so... complete coolness. To this day, I think she's the one musician who I said, God, if there's ever a musician I wish was my best friend, it was Nana Cherry.
Nana Cherry and Manchild. Marlon James, you studied English language and literature at the University of the West Indies. How did you find student life?
I love student life. It was weird being part of the cool kids suddenly. We'd show up in the library, we'd take over the second floor, we'd be playing anything from EPMD to Bad Brains. We're smoking and drinking. We're not eating any food because we're young and pretty and we don't need food. We save our money for alcohol. And it was actually pretty fantastic, actually. But college was so set apart from let's call it the real world, that it was pretty traumatic going to work. because as soon as I hit work, I ran back into the same people I left behind in high school, and they were still narrow-minded, and they were still homophobic, and they were still very just not understanding.
So you got a job as a copywriter,
mm-hmm.
And like you say, after this kind of grace period in college, you're suddenly back in the real world.
Which surprised me, because it was an ad agency. I thought, oh, everybody here will be creative and everybody here will be progressive. No, actually, it wasn't. It was a lot like going back to high school. It was just so oppressive. It was so oppressive and so depressing, I think. And I'm sometimes amazed I made it through it.
Were you writing yet?
No. I wrote in college, and I did creative writing, and it was really... I even got an A. But for some reason, I'm not sure why, I didn't follow it. I didn't pursue it for years. One reason, maybe because I was a copywriter, so I was writing way too much and all the time anyway. But writing by committee, and writing to please people who wanted the soundbite, the five-word thing. Mm-hmm. They wanted Think Mink. I didn't come up with that, but...
And, what sort of campaigns did you work on?
Mostly corporate stuff for banks. There's nothing wrong with advertising. There's nothing wrong with being in a creative field. I think sometimes that is it can be a godsend. But I think you need to know if you're a writer doing copy or a copywriter. You need to know if you're an artist doing graphics or you're a graphic artist. You know, you need to know if you're a singer doing commercials or you're a commercial singer. Those are not the same things. And if you're a writer doing copy, if you're an artist doing graphics, you have to have an exit strategy. Because you are creating via compromise and you're going to spend a long part of your life doing it. There are so many cautionary tales in my own industry. People who are doing commercials for 30 years and go, I'm going to do my feature film now. No, you're not. And no, they haven't. And those who did do their sort of artistic work, it was terrible.
And what was your exit strategy, if you had one?
Get suspended from the job and walk off. I also took all the books because I knew nobody in the department was going to read them.
What did you get suspended for?
I went on a photo shoot and he thought I didn't have to go. He thought I was chasing girls. I'm like, somebody didn't get the memo. I ended up writing fiction, not to sell it or not to have a career, but because I wanted some aspect of writing that was mine and mine alone. So I didn't even intend to publish that first novel. I wrote it just to prove that I could make something that was just mine.
Tell me about your fifth disc. Why have you chosen it?
Jane's Addiction, Summertime Rose. It was so different from 80s rock and 80s hard rock. Because we're talking about 80s hard rock, we're thinking of hair metal, which I like. But it's everything about Jane's Addiction sounded and looked different. It didn't have hair mousse. He had dreads. They didn't look like people who were dating Tawny Kitaen and whichever model people were dating. They actually looked like drug addicts, quite frankly, which they turned out to be. The sound was like nothing else out there. This was not You Give Love a Bad Name.
Fell into a sea of breath and shady blades, the children all ran over me, screaming, "Tam, you are the one."
Jane's Addiction and Summertime Rolls. So, Marlon James, towards the end of the 90s, you joined an evangelical church in Jamaica, and you've spoken about that period as a time when you wanted to pray away the gay.
Mm-hmm.
What was church like? What was a typical service like?
Actually, church was pretty joyous, actually. I quite liked church. I think because it was just so contemporary, the church, you know, the musicians played reggae. In Jamaica, we call it a clap hands church, meaning that it was just lots of praise and worship and so on. I really threw myself into it. I was at church nearly every day of the week. But I know I couldn't deal with the anti-intellectualism of church. I couldn't deal with feeling like every time I entered the church, I had to set my brain on dim. The homophobia is going to get to me sooner or later. And then there was a certain kind of narrowness that was looked upon as a virtue. And I'm like, I will never think of ignorance as a virtue.
And were you at that point able to talk to friends about your sexuality? Did they know you were gay?
Well, I didn't know I was gay. The cool thing about church is that church, you can put things like that on hold for as long as you want. You know, we're all repressed together. We're all, let's just forget all emotion and think God will provide. You know, God is going to provide a wife who will understand my quote-unquote struggle.
Is that what you wanted?
Yeah, I wanted it more than anything. That's why I eventually had my sort of exorcism to drive out the gay.
Tell me about that experience.
In hindsight, I realize it's extreme ex-gay therapy. Back then, I thought they were just driving out demons. But it's the same thing. I think it's a kind of mental control, actually. It's to subject you to so much sort of intense and immediate emotional turmoil that you almost respond to it, scatologically. So in the room were barf bags, and I filled all of them up. And it was just this relentless, everything you say, that's not you, that's a demon. Be gone, Satan. And you're like, but it's me. I go, okay, they may be right. Maybe it's just the devil in my mouth. And all of that. And, man, this has turned into a really intense hour. No, we can say, you know, sometimes that person isn't possessed. They're just dealing with schizophrenic issues. Or the person isn't demons. A person is just a lesbian. And so on. But back then, I wanted to believe it really badly, so yeah.
And what happened after that?
1 or 2 or 3 months of quote-unquote purity. And within the third month, all the attractions and all the lusts and all those things all came roaring back. But funny enough, I had a lot of clarity after that one. And I said, man, maybe that exorcism did work. Because I've tried getting rid of the sin. Well, I wasn't really committing any, but wanted to. And that didn't work. And I've tried to get rid of the temptation, and that didn't work. And I tried to get rid of the whole cycles of forgiveness and blah, 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 and that didn't work. And then one day it hit me, what if I got rid of the church? And that worked smashingly.
And what's your relationship with faith today? Do you have any?
Sometimes. I think I'm too much of a wuss to become an atheist. But I don't think I have faith anymore.
Let's go to the music. It's your 6th disc. Why have you chosen it?
Around the time, here comes Nirvana. And there's a line of notes in the Incesticide album where he talks about all these people, homophobes, sexist, blah, blah. If you're that person, he said a whole bunch of words I can't say on the air. And don't come to our concerts and don't buy our records. It was the first time I felt like somebody got my back. So Nirvana is super special to me.
Like Teen Spirit by Nirvana. Marlon James, and you moved to America in 2007 because you got a job teaching creative writing. Did moving to America change your writing?
Yeah.
How?
It did. I think I'm a looser and freer writer. I don't think I could have written Brief History of Seven Killings in Jamaica. It's not just because I'm writing about killers who may still be alive or people who were connected to killers who may still be alive, most of whom I've met post Brief History. I think I would have had a failure of nerve. I don't know if I'd written the queer parts. And I don't think I would have felt safe to write what is maybe a dangerous book. That the style for me became looser. I think I was very much over-obsessed with what a novel should read like. Mm. And what a novel should sound like. And with that book, which is the first novel I wrote totally in the States, I think that freedom shows itself in the ways in which I'd allow it to slip into stream of consciousness or lots of run-on sentences or multiple characters and shifting time frames sort of abruptly. I think all of that is because I moved and lived somewhere else.
In the early days in the States, I read that you did a lot of kind of high-level code switching, sometimes involving actual costume changes.
Oh, yeah.
Talk me through that.
God, I'm queer. I've been living extensively in the U.S. since 99, meaning I'll come to the States and be there for like 5 months or 6 months out of the year. So I used to have this ritual because I was living in the Bronx, and the Bronx was a very Jamaican community. And I don't know about the Jamaican communities here as much as I do in America, but they're even more conservative in the diaspora. So I'm dealing with people who are nostalgic for Jamaica, very, very conservative, very homophobic, very, very suspicious of difference. So when I was in the Bronx, I dress as normal and as hip-hoppy as I can. There's a limit to it for it. I mean, look at me. I'm a nerd. I can't be hip-hop. But as normal and straight-laced as I can, a sensible shirt and then baggy pants and sensible sneakers, and I would take the 5 train from way up in the Bronx. It's an hour's trip all the way down to Union Square. I'd go into the Barnes & Noble disabled bathroom because it was wider, and I'd go in, take off all my normal straight clothes and put on all my fabulously gay queer clothes. It'd usually be skin-tight jeans with the obscenely low-rise, combat boots. I'd put on like my Stereolab t-shirt. And they're strutting all over downtown New York like some peacock. Nobody from Jamaica goes lower than 125th Street. But it was like Cinderella because I had to get back before Barnes & Noble closed. 10 o'clock and I'm like, oh crap, I have 15 minutes or I'll be stuck in these clothes and have to go back to the Bronx. So I would dash back to Barnes & Noble, switch back into my normal people clothes, and then jump on the train and head back up to the Bronx. And I would do that nearly every day.
How long was it until you stopped?
I stopped when I moved to Minnesota. I think that may be one of the reasons why the idea of a job so far away was great to me, is that I could start over in exactly the version of myself that I wanted. And I decided there, I had my own personal don't ask, don't tell. I'm not going to talk about my life, but if you asked me, I would tell you. Mm-hmm. I was going to have 2 different versions of myself in Minneapolis. So that's where.
Let's go with the music. This is your 7th disc. Tell me about choosing this one.
Prince, When Doves Cry, was back in 1984. I was 14. Purple Rain was the first album I ever bought. The first time I heard When Doves Cry, first time I heard Prince, I don't know how to describe it in a way that's really articulate. I'll just say it electrified me. Prince immediately became and remains my favorite artist of all time. It's funny, I had no idea I was so well known as a Prince fan until Prince died and almost every major station, and I'm talking NBC, CBS, called, could you give us a word about Prince? I'm like, how do you know? And also, don't bother me, I'm too busy crying. I was crying the whole day. To be completely honest, I cried more about Prince's death than my dad's death.
Prince and When Doves Cry. So, Marlon James, have you ever made a pilgrimage to Paisley Park?
You know, and you're going to bring up my criminal past.
Well, we do our research. What can I say?
So it was my 38th birthday, and we were all kind of drunk, and a friend of mine, Holly, says, I know what we should do. We should drive to Paisley Park and break in and tag the door and run back out. And, of course, me being... it's my birthday, and me being not sober, think this is the greatest idea ever. This is a pretty long drive. So I had a very long time to realize this is a bad idea. Except it's the most awesome idea ever, so whatever. And we drive, and we finally make it to Paisley Park. It's night, nobody's there. This is a huge gate. We're going to climb over the gate. We're going to run to touch the first wall in Paisley Park and come back up. As I literally instantly touch the gate, all the floodlights go off. An alarm goes off. Suddenly there are armed guards everywhere. There might be cops, there might be anything. I was like, we're freaking out. I didn't say this. My friend started screaming, we're English teachers, we're English teachers. We're not things. We're English teachers, we're English teachers. Funny enough, the guys are such good sports. I guess because they believe we were English teachers. And we spent pretty much the rest of the night with them telling us all the hilarious stories of who shows up at Prince's Gate.
There's a certain amount of consternation about the violence in your books, mm-hmm. Marlon James. What's your assessment of that conversation of, you know, who decides how much is too much?
I don't think my books are all that as loaded with violence as people say. I think there's a difference between preponderance and resonance. Of course, my violence is going to resonate because violence comes with suffering. I mean, the reader's a choice not to read it. But I do think a lot of that kind of criticism of violence is hypocritical. One of the reactions people had to my second novel, which is about slavery, which doesn't flinch from it either, again, it's too violent. I couldn't possibly read that. I don't know if I can handle reading such cruelty. My response to that was, you know what? Reading about a slave getting whipped is probably hard. It's a little easier than getting whipped. Reading about abuse is probably hard. It's probably a little nicer than being abused. You don't have to endure these things, but you should know what they are. I actually think we've become weaker readers. And I've heard people say that. Say, I don't want to deal with that. I read literature to escape that. I was like, all right, fine. But that was not what literature is for. I mean, if that were the case, we wouldn't have a single Shakespeare play.
I'm going to cast you away to the desert island now. Are you looking forward to being alone?
For a time being, and then I'll turn into Ben Gunn and go crazy, I think.
How practical are you? Can you build a shelter?
I'm pretty practical. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty handy. To the point where it really annoys me when people are not. I was like, but you have this, this, and this. It's not, you don't have to be MacGyver. Like, you just survive. Figure it out.
I read that you're a pretty good cook.
Yeah. I'm always thrown off when people ask me, the second question people ask is, what can you cook? It's like, what do you mean? Either you can cook or you can't cook. Give me something and I'll prepare it for you. So I just need to know the thing on the island is edible. And it will be roasted on Monday. It will be sautéed on Tuesday. It will be boiled on Wednesday. We will eat it raw on Thursday. It's like, nah, I'm good.
Getting hungry. Let's have some music. This is your eighth and final disc.
Radiohead in Limbo. Radiohead is probably the last band I obsess over. I am exactly that type of annoying Radiohead fan that people hear about. Right down to hating the old stuff. Well, hating the first album. It's one of those songs. They have quite a few of them. It just seems to just show up. It just is. It doesn't begin. It doesn't end. You kind of slide into it. When you hear it, you sound like it was been going on for a while and you're catching up to it. You know, as a roving, busy adult, it's a song that slows me down. And it's a song that made me stop and pay attention, which is funny because it's also a song that technically goes nowhere.
Radiohead and In Limbo. Marlon James, I'm about to cast you away to your desert island. I will send you there with the Bible and the complete works of Shakespeare to read. You can also choose another book to take with you. What will yours be?
Man, probably Tom Jones. Because I remember, God, you're taking me back to high school, and the GC syllabus actually has tons of books you could read. And every book my teacher has picked was the wrong book. And I was like, you know what? I'm done with this crap. I'm going to go to the GCE office, get a copy of the syllabus and see what's on there. And I'm going to do that. And I went through and I saw Tom Jones. I didn't know what it was, but I knew it was the first book in the list where I remember seeing in a bookstore. Went and bought Tom Jones. And man, I had the most rollicking time. Good Lord. That book was so hilarious and so bawdy and so rude and so much fun. It's also really long. And I'm going to be there for a really long time.
You can also have a luxury item, something that'll soften the blow of being cast away. What would you like?
I want a pressure cooker.
Okay.
Because chances are some of those things are inedible. But 2 hours in a pot and steaming that, at least, you know, coconut husk is going to be really good after 2 hours of steaming.
A pressure cooker it is then. Finally, which of these eight discs would you rush to save from the waves if they were going to be washed away?
I have a feeling I'd follow them in the waves and drown myself. What would I save? What would I rush out and grab? I probably would rush out and grab the prince.
Marlon James, thank you very much for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thank you so much for having me.
I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Marlon. We've cast away many writers and Booker Prize winners to our island, including Margaret Atwood, Pat Barker and Arundhati Roy. In 1988, Sue Lawley spoke to Salman Rushdie.
So, Salman, Cambridge wasn't as bad as you feared?
No, I mean, it was a good time to be at university. I was at university from 65 to 68, which was, I suppose, the years of student power and all the kind of turbulence at the time. And it was also an awakening for me in all sorts of ways. I mean, first of all, it was an awakening to the fact that there were other sorts of people in this country than the kinds that I'd encountered at public school, and that it was possible to enjoy an English experience, so to speak. And I did. I had a very good time there.
You were in Footlights, the Review Society.
I was a tiny bulb in Footlights, yes. There were lots of people who were much bigger.
Did you flash on and off?
No, I mean, actually, I did much more kind of straight acting than Footlights there. I mean, I think I was only once on a Footlights stage.
But you wanted to be an actor.
I did. It was the other thing that I thought that I might have done. And actually, it was also a kind of cover in case I couldn't be a writer. Really, and I was really quite terrified of discovering that I couldn't be a writer.
That you read history, didn't you?
I did. Yeah.
And you left there with a good degree?
No, I left there with a very average degree, a sort of extremely undistinguished second.
And you went into advertising?
Well, no. First, I went into acting in London, and you know, on the fringe theatre. I spent a while doing that, and then when I was starving to death, I went into advertising. But I mean, in fact, I remember a show which kind of connects with the next bit of music, where we had to be in a Vietnam protest play called Viet Rock, which we sang various songs, including this one. But I remember it particularly because there was a part of it where it was very fashionable in those days to insult the audience. I mean, audiences didn't feel they'd had their money's worth unless they'd been insulted, abused a little bit. So there was a bit of this where we were supposed to improvise, abusing the audience about their passivity, about the Vietnam War and so forth. And on this particular day, the entire segment of the audience that I was supposed to abuse was consisted of a coach party of paraplegics. And I was absolutely terrified. I thought, I can't do this. You know, the director told me I had to go out and do it. It was the show. And so, of course, you had to use what there was there. So you had to tell people that just because they were cripples didn't excuse them from having a political conscience and so forth. And I came out sweating blood. And they came backstage afterwards and said they'd never had such a good time in the theatre because they were pleased to have been treated as the rest of, just like
well,
the rest of the
right,
audience.
Right. You know? I can't imagine you, Salman, in advertising. Did you get on very well?
The thing is, I found it quite easy. I mean, I wasn't outstanding at it, but I could do it to a kind of level of competence without really engaging my brain.
What, copywriting?
Copywriting, yes. So I could do it, you know, a couple of days a week and make a living.
Come on, give us a jingle. You must have written a few.
Well, I did write a few. I mean, I suppose, I mean, I don't know that I can say this on the BBC, but I did. I did. There are one or two chocolate bars, and actually, cream cakes was probably the most famous slogan that I ever was responsible for. Naughty but nice.
Is that yours?
Yeah.
Salman Rushdie talking to Sue Lawley in 1988. Don't forget you can listen to many more editions from the Desert Island Discs back catalogue via BBC Sounds. Next time, my guest will be Jacqueline de Rojas, the CEO of Tech UK. I do hope you'll join us.
Beyond Today is the daily podcast from Radio 4. It asks one big question about one big story in the news and beyond.
Just how big is Netflix?
Why are young people getting lost in the system?
I'm Tina Dehealy.
I'm Matthew Price.
And along with a team of curious producers, we are searching for answers that change the way we see the world.
I was actually quite shocked by how many people this issue affects.
So we're doing stories about technology, about identity.
Are you trying to look black?
No. I am not trying to look black.
Power, where power lies, how it's changing.
And every weekday we speak to the smartest people in the BBC and beyond.
It's basically what I've been wanting to do since I was little. It's talk about business and economics.
And the stories started forming in my head.
That's what I've learned. It's okay to feel.
Subscribe to us on BBC Sounds.
And join in on the hashtag Beyond Today.